We respectfully acknowledge the traditional owners of country throughout Australia where this podcast was recorded as the first storytellers, the first communities, and the first creators of Australian culture. We pay our respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. Hi there, I'm Daniel Moore, and you're listening to Season 4 of the Hearing Architecture Podcast, proudly sponsored by Brickworks. In this episode, I'm speaking with registered architect Kate Shepherd, based in Tasmania and working for Cumulus Studio. Kate has been working across practice and academics in architecture since 2011. Kate has had an extraordinary career working in academia at the University of Canberra, as well as in practice, where she demonstrated design excellence across various scales of practice, both domestically and internationally. In 2022, Kate received the Emerging Architect Prize in the ACT before she made the move to Hobart and began working for Cumulus Studio. Kate and I discussed the journey she undertook as an emerging architect, what led her to make the choice to move to Tasmania, and the building typologies she is most passionate about now after working on various projects and scales over the years. Let's jump in. All right. Well, thank you so much, Kate, for joining me today on the Hearing Architecture Podcast. How are you going down in beautiful Hobart?
I am good. It's definitely not sunny Hobart today, but it's a good day.
Yeah, very nice. So, yeah, I've got a soft spot for Hobart. That's where I grew up. But the first time we ever met in person was down in Hobart for the Emerging Architect Prize Tour, where you were the ACT recipient. But then after you received that award, you then moved to Hobart. So, you sort of experienced working as an architect in a few different places, both in Australia and around the world. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your experience before you entered the Emerging Architect Prize?
Yeah, I guess there was quite a lot that came before entering the Emerging Architect Prize. I think one of the citations on the award was that I was emerging, but I think Jane Cassidy said that I was also enduring, which I was shocked about. But yeah, so I guess I started practicing or working in an office while I was still at uni at Colin Stewart Architects, which is now Stewart Architecture, where I got a lot of experience about what it means to work in an office and how different that is to what we learn at uni. And I think I went through uni at the same time as Sarah Lebner, who started the...
Oh, yeah. Well, it's my first architecture job.
My first architecture,
yes. Yeah, and she also wrote the book, I think it was 101 Things I Didn't Learn in Architecture School.
Yes. So I guess we both had similar experiences in that there was a big disparity between the two. And so it was a good way to navigate, I guess, what the demands of the industry were and then still have a creative foot in study. And so pretty soon after I finished uni, I became a sessional tutor at the uni in different design studios. And then I went on to manage lead some of the design studios for undergrad and master students, which was pretty exciting. And I guess that kept my foot again in the design process, but also the sort of logistics of being an architect.
Yeah, wonderful.
Yeah.
And what did you find was the biggest difference between what you were studying at university and what was happening in practice, so that then you could assist students and also maybe try to demystify what was happening for people that had the same experience that still goes on at architecture schools?
Yeah, architecture school it's important. You learn it's design thinking, it's problem solving and critically sort of reviewing a set of constraints and then coming up with a solution to them. So I think that's something that's applicable or applicable to so many different aspects of work, whether it's to be an architect or another profession. But the things that they don't teach you is all of the, I guess, less creative things, which is the legalities of work and building standards and contracts and, writing professional emails and all of that sort of stuff, liaising with consultants and working as a team. I think university is very much a solo game. And when you're out practicing, you realize just how much of a team job it is and how many people actually come together to form projects.
Yeah. Yeah, that coordination piece between everyone who's in the team is so massive, I find, and that while you're studying in architecture school, you're delivering your own projects. Sometimes there's group work that doesn't always shake out exactly as it would in an architecture project. So, yeah, that's a huge learning curve that I think a lot of people come up against as soon as they leave uni, for sure.
Yeah, that's not just about a single idea. It's about there's lots of different ideas and different stakes on the project that need to be incorporated, which I guess is then an extension of that problem solving and coming back with a good response to a brief.
Yeah. And just talking about the work that you were doing in practice and then also the sessional teaching that you were doing, there were a lot of side projects that you had while you were part of the architecture community in the ACT. Did you want to tell us a little bit about the work that you did there?
Yeah, I guess maybe I've skipped a whole section, but when I was studying, I studied in Finland for 12 months, which was a pretty incredible experience. And I think it was the first time that I had left Australia and the first time that I had sort of that level of independence and anonymity to do whatever I wanted. You know, there wasn't other people's expectations of me on school. So that was quite exciting and I think massively eye-opening. I got to travel and see a lot of the projects that I'd studied, which I never expected to be able to do. And I came back and worked again. Colin Stewart took me back, thankfully. And then I stayed for 2 years and then headed back overseas and worked with FJMT in the UK at their Oxford studio, which was incredible. And lots of work with lots of different consultants and different, I guess, user groups, and it's much more complex projects than what I'd been working on in Canberra. And I guess that kind of, to make friends, I joined lots of different committees there. They have an equivalent to Imagine here, the Emerging Graduates Committee, that's called Youth for Change, I think, or Engineers for Change. But it was a committee that brought together consultants and architects. It wasn't just a singular sort of initiative, which I think was great. So I met a lot of people and did a lot of, yeah, side things and held different events and hosted things. So that kind of got me excited about the possibilities of being able to do that sort of thing back here in Australia. I guess I took that and joined Imagine when I returned and hosted quite a few events. And I joined the Canberra Street Theatre and was a board member there for a number of years, which was really exciting.
So for those people who don't know what that is, do you want to tell us about what that actually is?
What being a board member means?
Or what the Canberra Street Theatre is. Street Theatre.
Yeah, so it is a local theatre group that is publicly funded by the Arts ACT Grants, which is a Canberra initiative. And it sits in the ANU campus. And it was actually a project that I worked on as a student, the extension of that at Colin Stewart Architects many years before. So I sort of had connections to the street theatre that way. And growing up, my dad built theatre sets in his spare time for productions, and my sister performed in different shows down at ANU. So I sort of had that connection already, and a position came up and I applied for it. And so that was the board reviews how the theatre, I guess, uses their money and what sort of projects they fund, and also just reviews, I guess, the theatre as a business. So that was an interesting sort of side project to being an architect and seeing how a business works and how they employ designers to do their work as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I guess that's something that wouldn't really come up while you're studying architecture, and that goes to the procurement side of how architects might be assessed to work on projects or contractors as well, which can also help while you might be studying for your architect's practice exam. So yeah, that would have been a really eye-opening experience in a way to bring together some of your, you know, what you may have been hearing about from your dad when he was coming home talking to you about the sets that he was building, and also your sister being actually on some of these stages and performing. So that's an interesting way to conflate all of the different backgrounds that you had and the things that you were studying.
Yeah, and I think it was also a good lesson in professionalism in that, I mean, I was still working in an architecture practice and we were bidding for jobs, and you can't just give your friends jobs. You've got to actually review things. And yeah, it was a nice sort of sidestep.
Yeah, great. And so you've also been doing some writing for Sanctuary magazine, and you were involved in Chapter Council with the Australian Institute of Architects in the ACT and the AACA. So yeah, how did you cram all of that in while you're an emerging practitioner?
I guess I love to say yes to things. Yeah, when I'm given the opportunity, and I guess if somebody's asked me, they already think that maybe I would be appropriate at whatever the thing is that they're asking me for, I would hope. And so I've been approached, or I was approached by, it was actually Jenny from Lighthouse Architecture and Science that got me the gig with Sanctuary Magazine, as well as the AACA, that they were looking for people to review the practice exam questions and review previous ones and write new questions. Yeah, which I guess then sort of makes you revisit all of the PALS lessons and registration and unlearn the things that you've been doing wrong since getting registered.
Yeah, absolutely. You sort of start to hear the different stories about the way that people are practicing, and you start to think, oh gosh, it'd be really great to put that into a question on the APE exam, because it's, yeah, it sounds like maybe a lot of people do it one way, but then this other way is probably the more correct way of doing it, or there are two ways of doing things. So that's one of those great APE questions, or there might actually be two answers and not just one.
Well, but now they don't do that, which is a great thing. So there's only one correct answer, which I think is, yeah, they realized that actually the way that they were judging people was not actually fair and equitable, and people like were put under duress to answer questions rather than actually responding.
And I remember, you know, going through that process, and everyone was sort of faced, like, knowing that that was probably going to be coming up in the written exam, that we'd have to do a little bit of mental arithmetic starting when you read through all the questions to say, okay, how many of these do I think there could be a two answer in? So I better make a calculated assessment of which ones I'm confident with and which ones I think not so certain about.
Yeah. And I guess then the other thing is that as a practicing architect, you're never going to be put in a situation where you have to respond on the spot. You can always say, I'll come back to you and I will find the right answer. So
yeah, absolutely.
They're moving in a good direction, I think, with the practice exam.
Yeah, definitely. That sounds great. So yeah, I guess it's really great to hear that you had all of those different experiences that you could, so you could try, you know, all of the different skills that you have. So around about the time after you'd done all of these things, I think we had COVID was on the horizon. And were you having a bit of a think about what direction to go in, or were you totally confident that you just wanted to do all of these different things as part of what your architecture career would be in comparison to more of a singular track in the architecture profession?
Yeah, I think COVID put a massive halt on what my plans were. When I got back from the UK, my plan was just to come back to Australia, make a bit of money and head back over. And that became impossible pretty quickly when borders got shut down. So I think for a lot of people, it was a time to sort of stop and think and reconsider what you were doing. And I think my whole career, I'd been ticking a lot of boxes that I think, or I thought needed to be ticked. And, you know, I got registered as quickly as I could. I studied overseas, and then I went and worked overseas, and then I came back and I worked in an office, and I was promoted to associate. And so I'd been ticking all of these boxes, and I'd never really stopped to think, like, what do I actually want to do and what do I want to be as a as an architect? So I think, yeah, COVID was a good initiator of pausing and thinking. And I'd never worked on single residential projects. And so being, I guess, sort of locked down in the ACT gave me the opportunity to think about a different career path. And I did leave the office and work with a small sole practitioner at Rob Henry Architects, which was great. It meant that it was completely different work environment, completely different work. And I felt like I had no idea what I was doing when I started, but it really got me back in touch with like projects and I guess all of the different stages of a project. When you work in a big commercial office, you can quickly be pigeonholed into delivering just one part of a sort of the design project. In single res, you've got to do everything. You've got to start from the concept. You've got to, you know, put in the DA, go through the BA with the surveyor and then finish it with the contract admin. So it was, yeah, a steep learning curve, but I am very thankful for that opportunity with Rob.
Yeah, I think that's always great for people who have been working in bigger practices to have a have some experience in small practices, even at one time or another, to touch base on all of those processes throughout the architectural process from beginning to end. I know that in big practices, they try to give you that experience. Yeah, when you're the main point of contact in a small project and you're getting to know the clients quite well and the builder, that's an experience that it's hard to replicate on large projects. I mean, they're obviously very, very different in terms of the delivery and procurement and the client engagement. But, yeah, I think that experience would have been great to sort of broaden your mind after getting very, very used to work in one particular way. So what sort of things did you start to think about when you were considering, you know, now do I go down this small resi practice route or is Australia for me? What did you sort of, how did you weigh up the pros and cons for those things?
I think this is a hard one because I'm going to admit that I gave away all control in that situation and we'd been locked down in Canberra and I had been really driving my career and basically telling my partner what we were doing. And during COVID, he'd gone and studied a master's in Melbourne and he was graduating. And when he got back, I said, when you apply for a job, I don't care where it is, but it can't be in Canberra. And make sure, like, whatever it is, it's something that you really want to do. So I think that's why we're in Tasmania. And I would have preferred to go somewhere maybe a bit warmer originally, considering that I'd taken myself to sort of basically the Arctic Circle and then the UK. But yeah, I think I was very fortunate that this is where he picked because it's been a great place to come. And I had a bit of time not working just to reflect on what I actually wanted to be doing. And I guess thinking about sort of what my values were and what sort of practice that I wanted to work for rather than just sort of following the path that I thought everybody wanted me to do.
Yeah. No, I can understand that after you've been in one city for a very long time, you get the itch and you really want to have change. And, Hobart and rest of Tasmania is a beautiful place. So I'm sure there's a lot of great opportunities to reconnect with nature and explore the beautiful natural state that Tassie is. So what did you, I mean, so for me, I guess on those fronts, you know, Tassie's kind of a great option. What were you looking for when you were looking for a practice to work for in Tassie?
I guess it was, I'd realized that I didn't love working on single residential projects. I think that architecture can have a really big impact for lots of people and it can have a really positive impact. And I think it's great that people can afford to, you know, sort of curate a house for themselves that fits their needs perfectly. But we're in a housing crisis and lots of people need housing. And so I think it was looking for a practice that had sort of social, a social drive as well as you know, managing to balance that with beautiful sort of sustainable projects. And I was very fortunate at the architecture awards that I went to for when you were crowned the national prize winner.
I wish there was a crown and a cake. That'd be, I want both. Yes.
In my memory, I think you do have both of those things when you collected the award.
Yeah, sure. I did, may have brought my own props. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I bumped into, or I met Peter Walkoff from Cumulus Studio, and sort of the rest is history.
Yeah.
Yeah, lucky. But I would love to hear, because I know, so because I'd moved from Canberra quite soon after being crowned the emerging architect, I guess I didn't really experience, I didn't get to go around on the tour and give my talk, although you did invite me down here, thank you, to join Jason, the Tassie winner, on your talk. But I guess I kind of felt like I'd won this big award in Canberra, and I was this big fish in a little pond, and then I moved to Tasmania and nobody knew me and I was walking around like an absolute nobody. So I didn't really experience what it was to be an emerging architect prize winner.
Right.
But you quickly shifted from running your own practice after winning the award to being the state manager of the Institute in Victoria. And I would love to hear what made you make that choice and what your experience has been.
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is your podcast. So, I mean, I'll say it quickly because I really want to get back to you. But, I mean, we can have a bit of a dialogue about it, both of our experiences. So, yeah, after I'd won the Victorian leg, the position was becoming open and they were looking for someone. And yeah, not too long before we went to Sydney for the announcement of the national EAP winner, yeah, did I come on board at the Institute. And actually, when they asked me to apply for the role, the first thing I said was no, because I was so focused on growing my practice. And then I had a second conversation with Michael Linke, one of the general managers of the Institute. And he said, you know, well, we'd be open to trialing a 3-day-a-week role. And that's how I started. And many of my clients that I had, about half of them, we discussed how little time I had left. So half of my clients left. And I've actually still got a couple of clients on the books. But I basically work with another small practice, John Lowe Architects, based here in Melbourne. And he does the lion's share of the work and gets the lion's share of the fee. So it's a way for me to still use my architectural skills, because it's a really hard thing to give up entirely. And the reason that it sort of got me over the line, it wasn't just the ability to still work in architecture. It was that many of the advocacy pieces that I work on, they are still a huge part of my life and in my career. And after saying no, I discussed it with my partner and she said, you know, oh, so you're going to keep doing all this advocacy work for nothing? And, you know, you put all these hours into it and, you know, you have to work all of this extra time at night where we don't get to see each other very much, so maybe you want to think about that again. And decided, yeah, I'll actually give it a go, and then realized that many of my skills did align with what the Institute wanted. So took that on board, and it has, what's been very interesting at the Institute is that they try to look into what skills you have and experience you have and see where they can use them as best as possible for the Institute. So being able to, you know, run events and work in the policy or support the policy and advocacy team, work with chapter council, help facilitate a lot of what the committees want to deliver. That's been, and also just working with my Victorian chapter team, that's been really fruitful and it's been a really fulfilling experience. And so while we had discussed a 12-month appointment, yeah, I've decided to stay on longer. And it's, yeah, been really great, I think, for anyone who's interested in work beyond, I guess, pure project delivery. There's some practices that I think have an advocacy remit that they try to deliver, but working within the Institute, yeah, has really expanded that. So that's been, yeah, really great for me. Yeah.
Yeah, nice. I think, I guess, when I saw your presentation down here in Taz, I think Jason had a similar style of presentation in that he'd had a lot of starts and stops and times to pause and think. And I feel like I'd had quite a similar career. And I wonder if maybe there's lots of other people out there these days having similar sorts of goes and stops and pause and breaks and sort of sidesteps into to different things, and that maybe sort of the traditional role of an architect is changing, and that it's no longer, you know, you go and work in an office and in 50 years' time you become the director, I think.
No, I would agree. Yeah, and I think that's there's a generational shift happening that I see when architects present their work. While I was studying, it seemed like most architects, either by necessity or by design, wanted to have a portfolio that included every typology you could possibly think of on their books. And in recent years, I've been seeing more and more practices that will be happy to say, no, we are purely single residential, or we are purely multi-residential, maybe a little bit of other things thrown in. And I think the idea of either purely being a specialist or being a generalist, I think that's a very live conversation. We don't have to just be a generalist to say that you're an architect. And also you don't have to go down the path of a specialist. Everyone's going through this real roller coaster of a career journey. And so maybe when I was at university, was at the tail end of people saying, you know, design your career almost before you begin and start to, you know, throw all of your eggs in that basket and become really, really hot in resi or what interests you, and then, you know, go for your life, go in that direction. And I think now, yeah, we're hearing more of these stories like yours as well, where we sort of try a lot of different things, see what fits, and then also seeing some great stories of people trying something for maybe, you know, 10 or 15 years and then having a moment of clarity and thinking, you know what, I think I've done my dash in that lane. Now I'd like to reassess and jump over into a different lane. And that's or saying, you know, I'm really comfortable in this lane now. I might actually expand into a separate one. So do you feel like that's something that you're seeing as well? Is that there's like an expansion or a mutation of what practice actually is anymore in terms of the expectation of an architect?
I think so. And I think that, I mean, in the practices that I've worked in, there's been, I guess, more of a social push and advocacy in sort of speaking to what is an architect and how can architects save the world? You know, what impact can we have in that? And I think definitely at the conference last year, you know, the main topic was really like, what are architects now? Where do we go from here? You know, we're in a climate crisis and the number one contributor to fossil fuels or carbon release is construction, and we're leading the charge in building more things. So I think it's definitely made a lot of people think about, you know, what can we do? How do we use our skills as architects, but to do things differently?
Yeah. And I think that's your experience of wanting to go from single resi, where you've done a little bit of that work, into more multi-resi, where there's a housing crisis, and especially in Tasmania, there's, you know, we're seeing more and more people who are struggling with homelessness or access to housing. And I feel like that gives you also sort of helps you, I guess, inspire you to keep working every day and you know, keep delivering great results, not just for a singular client, but for the greater community. Have you seen some of those results, whether it's on the table in the drawings that you've been doing, working with a stakeholder like the Tasmanian government maybe, or after some projects have been delivered, seeing how the community has benefited from the work you've been doing?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't work on the Goulburn Street social housing that Cumulus did a couple of years ago, but I did live on Goulburn Street just across the road from it and saw directly how that project, I guess, helped a lot of people. It was almost like a halfway house. It was social housing, or it is social housing, but it just appears like any other housing on the street. And they were, you know, able to fit, I think it's like 20 apartments into a space where there would have otherwise been two houses. So it's yeah, made a big difference, I think, in the middle of Hobart. There's quite a few sort of churches and sort of social housing communities in that area, and there's also quite a lot of homelessness in the middle of Hobart. It's quite shocking, actually, the number of people that live in tents along the rivulet, like 100 metres away from people living in what I would call a mansion. Yeah, it's wild. So, yeah, we've been lucky to get quite a few or a number of other social housing projects off the back of that that are currently in the works or about to begin construction. Mm. So that's, yeah, definitely a big thing.
Mm. And how have you found that process in terms of the conversations we have around design, like and in the process of designing? Because in my experiences of working with, so I'd worked in large practice for a little while at Design Inc. doing institutional projects. So we'd work with consultant groups at universities to try to get feedback from the stakeholders about how the lab should work and how the teaching spaces should work. And that's one particular way of engaging with clients. And then with residential, when you're working with mums and dads, maybe even bringing the kids on board to have an input on what their house might be. That's also got a very direct way of working with people. So when you're working with these stakeholders, how do you find that design process and the sort of feedback loop of, you know, what are we actually designing here? Like you've drawn something, whether it's a room or a space for people to use. What are the benefits that the community will get out of this? How has that process been?
That one's quite tricky because on larger scale projects, you don't necessarily have the direct feedback from the end user, which you get in sort of, I guess, institutional projects with universities that allow you access to the people that are going to be using the building, or for single resi projects where you're directly speaking with the clients. So it's sort of filtered information that's coming through a lens of, I guess, a government agency that has experience with not necessarily how you can affect the way people act or live or are perceived, but more just like sort of, I guess, they just see this sort of end situation and not really how you can shift those things. So it's hard sometimes to sort of push for things that are a bit different and trying to find different solutions to those problems. But I think when you do get a really good client like we had with Homes Tasmania in the Golden Street housing, that there is a really great outcome and there is a feedback loop in that now that project is used to, I guess, inform new projects, and it's sort of a benchmark for what social housing can be. So I think that's great.
Yeah. No, it's quite interesting, and in other developments like Nightingale, where they have some social housing embedded in their towers, you mentioned before that it doesn't look like social housing. It is social housing.
It's just housing.
It's just housing.
Yeah.
Is that something that you had to develop your understanding of when you were coming around to designing something like social housing? Where there would still be a budget, and there would be a restriction on the materials that you could use. And so you're saying, oh, we don't want it to look like social housing, so let's use a really nice brick or something. Like, what process do you go through in that when you're saying, okay, we're designing social housing, but it will not look like social housing? How do you define that?
Yeah, that's another good question. I think every project has a budget, and I think all housing projects sort of multi-res projects have quite strict budgets. And when they're developer-driven, I think that money can be spent on making things look a particular way but not really focusing on the usability of things necessarily. And I guess social in sort of government-led projects, maybe it's less about that and more about usability, because the government's going to be maintaining projects and they want things to have longevity and, I guess, sort of a robustness of the materiality so that it doesn't need to be repaired often, which is a good thing. Mm. And I think that those sorts of materials are typically the ones that you would use in a standalone house. So it's about sort of humanizing the projects and using things like bricks rather than just precast concrete with, you know, donut windows and, you know, what is the simplest methodology for construction. It's really just about sort of like, yeah, the small scale interventions that you can have that make a bigger impact. It's about the tactility and the, yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that sounds right to me, because I guess the thing with precast panels might be that there is a perception problem that can come with precast panels. And if it's presented well for some people, it might belay those kind of conceptions that you might have of a material. And then for other people, it will always be this cold, hard material, and there's almost no way that you can dress it up. So I think, yeah, the idea of making an assessment of which materials would be suitable for what your project is and, you know, how it might be perceived either from the street or also internally, that's a really important thing that you have to go through.
And it's also, I guess, yeah, rationalizing where those materials go, because it doesn't, you know, the building still has to be built, so you can't just throw all the money at it. So knowing, yeah, the moments where you're actually touching the building or where you perceive it, definitely from the street, I think is a big one.
Yeah, definitely. And so your interest in this sort of, you know, helping the community and the urban realm, but now that you're doing some projects in housing with Cumulus, do you feel like now you're starting to settle into that typology, or are there other typologies that architects can work on that still also provide major benefits to the community beyond, you know, just the building itself?
In my mind, I'm thinking, are you edging towards, you know, public infrastructure like football stadiums, maybe? Could be a big impact on other people.
No, that I wasn't thinking that, but I was having a chat with someone inside the Institute the other day. Where, being based in Melbourne, a lot of people who haven't lived in Tassie might not really understand the feelings and thoughts around the stadium, the football stadium. That I was saying, you know, is there a way that we could just combine housing with the football stadium? Right. You know, it was a great project over in Copenhagen, which was a Colosseum arrangement student housing project. And on the interior side of the Colosseum were all of the public spaces, so all their shared games rooms, kitchens and all of those spaces. They were on the internal side facing in towards this park that was in the centre of it, and on the external side were all of the apartments. And I was thinking, could there be a way that you have all of the functions of a stadium on the interior building side of the football stadium, and then on the exterior, that we, you know, we have some sort of big central corridor that delineates the two, and then on the outside you have apartments built onto the outside, and that way you can get housing funding from the federal government, but then you can also get sports funding from the federal government. Might be too hard basket, I'm not sure.
I don't know. I reckon there's definitely something in there. I know there was an event down here that was held by the property council where they got a few different experts in building stadiums. And I think in London they do have similar projects, in that London is an old town with an old sort of heritage context, and they need big stadiums to sort of fit in with what, you know, the area that they're being built. So they do have, I think, stadiums with housing attached. And maybe, you know, whoever wins it, it would be great if they sort of led it with a sustainable sort of social-minded approach. I think that would be definitely, whoever gets it, they're going to have to win the public over.
Yeah, definitely.
Now that it seems like the Liberal government's back in power.
And so now, how long have you been living in Hobart?
18 months.
18 months, right. And do you think that, how do you feel about Hobart City and the being divided by the Derwent River? Mm-hmm. How do you feel about the urban growth of Hobart, and what do you think is the opportunities for it? Become very slowly getting larger, and, you know, so what are the problems inherent with Hobart and how it's slowly been growing?
I think Canberra and Hobart have some similarities in that. I mean, Hobart's not a planned city as Canberra is, but Canberra definitely has a big suburban creep filling in lots of the natural or open spaces. And Hobart's kind of doing that as well. But I think here it's more extreme in that everybody lives in houses. There's not much medium density, and the sort of high density apartments that are going up in town are typically sort of student accommodation or hotels. There's not really, there's a few good examples of multi-res starting to come online, but not many. And so I think that the perception of apartment living isn't great here. So I don't think that that's the way forward. but definitely there's a missing middle. And I know that that's something that every state and city is sort of grappling with at the moment, is sort of this push for higher density, but everybody's desire to have a block of land with their own backyard and a two-car garage or whatever it needs to be. So yeah, there definitely needs to be a sort of a review of the public infrastructure and the transport in Hobart, and maybe a freeze on building suburbs outside. I'm not a planner. I don't know.
Yeah, and public transport wise, how do you think they're going in Hobart? Do you think the buses are still sufficient, or I know there's been some chatter about trams?
Yeah, reinstating the trams.
Yeah,
I'm very fortunate in that I am able to live close to town and walk to work, so I don't have to deal with commuter problems. But definitely, when I ride my bike in the afternoon, it is gridlocked out on the highway, and it's almost like it's a Roman city. There's one way in and one way out, and if you're trying to get across the Derwent on the bridge and something's happened, like, it can be backed up for hours. So I think there's access to the water. I mean, is it Copenhagen? Yes, that's sort of based along the river, and they've got incredible ferries that transport people along the river from the opera house.
Yes.
So I think, maybe we don't need a stadium. Maybe we need a beautiful opera house. But, there's definitely opportunity to connect with ferries and light transport or light trains, I think, in Hobart to get cars off the road. There's just... that people are too attached to being able to drive from A to B without, walking on their feet.
Yeah. Well, I find that kind of, it's bringing up memories of when I was visiting Darwin, which was the second leg of my AIP tour, because so much of what I talked about was my work in Melbourne and how, a lot of the work that I was doing was aiming to be as sustainable as possible. And I had mentioned just sort of off the cuff, how great Passive House is. And we're saying, Darwin is definitely not Melbourne. very different architects. We've got very different clients. We've got a very different client. Mm-hmm. How have you felt with regards to the type of requests you may have gotten from your clients in Canberra and the architects you work with as well in Canberra versus the architects you work with and clients you work with in Hobart? Are there many differences, or is there... there are more similarities between Canberra and Hobart than we might understand?
Well, I mean, they're the same climate zone. So there's the same challenges it doesn't get as cold here in winter as it does in Canberra, but it does, and it probably doesn't get as hot in summer either, but it, it does go from one extreme to the other.
Yeah, which I think would surprise some people then when they understand that about Canberra, that it gets very, very cold.
Yeah, very, very cold and very, very hot.
Mm.
Yeah, so I think... maybe there's not as big a push down here for, more energy efficient design, and maybe people are less familiar with the sorts of things that we were doing in Canberra. So that's kind of, I'm very passionate about thermally broken windows in these sorts of climates, especially with the quality of construction is improving and building. Like, being able to seal buildings is something that builders really pride themselves on. But then there's lots of things that then come with a sealed building, like trapping condensation and mold. So there is also the world leader in condensation management, Mark Dewsbury, down here in Tasmania. So I think they've got, the right people here to handle the problems. It's just about how to roll those things out. But yeah, I think the clients are similar. They're asking for the same things.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think we're going to be wrapping up relatively soon, but I just wanted to ask you about, now that I'm not sure if you've settled in Tasmania or if there's still a bit of a move, you know, maybe a few years in the future on the horizon, but what are you starting to get really excited about in terms of architecture in Tasmania? Because, and the reason that I ask that is because I lived there until 2009, and now when I go back to visit, it actually feels like a different, that Hobart feels like a different city, and Tasmania as a whole does feel like a completely different state. So what are you excited about that might and will be built in Hobart and in Tasmania in the next 10 years?
Oh, that's a tough one. I'm not sure. I think the thing that makes Tasmanian architecture so interesting is that it is a bit isolated, and things have sort of been, for a very long time, you know, everything was of Tasmania because it's so hard to get different materials down here. So I think there's a beauty to the buildings that are here, and the older buildings, and maybe the new things aren't better.
Mm.
But I think Tasmanians celebrate their weirdness, and Mona's like a big advocate, like, you know, they instigated this. And so I'm sure that there'll be something weird that Mona does that will make it super cool. But I like the unknown, I think, of Tasmania, and the sort of, you uncover things and they're always surprising and a little bit weird.
Yeah, definitely. You know, there's some beautiful, weird architects and beautiful, weird buildings down there that really make it stand out and make it a very special place. So I'm sure we're going to be seeing some very incredible stuff from yourself and from Cumulus moving forward. But thank you so much for joining me today to be on the podcast. It was great to hear about your journey as an emerging architect and the move between Canberra to overseas and then down to Tassie around COVID. And, yeah, just hoping that you're having a fantastic time down there and looking forward to all of the great projects that you're working on. So thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. It's been really great to chat with you, Kate.
Thanks, Daniel. And, yeah, thanks for having me and for creating this incredible sort of advocacy opportunity. And for continuing to run it. Yeah, it's great.
No, it's great fun. All right. Thanks, Kate.
Great. Thanks, Dan.
This has been Hearing Architecture, proudly sponsored by Brickworks. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you so much to our guest, registered architect at Cumulus Studio, Kate Shepherd. Thank you so much for sharing about your unique career path in architecture, working in the ACT, internationally, now in Tasmania. We can't wait to see what you do next. Thanks a lot. Our sponsor Brickworks also produce architecture podcasts hosted by Tim Ross. You can find The Art of Living, Architects Abroad, and The Power of Two at brickworks.com.au or your favourite podcast platform. If you'd like to show your support, please rate, review, and subscribe to Hearing Architecture in your favourite podcast app. If you want to know more about the Australian Institute of Architects is doing to support architects and the community, please visit architecture.com.au. This is a production by the Australian Institute of Architects, Emerging Architects and Graduates Network, in collaboration with Open Creative Studio. The Institute production team was Madeline Jenkins and Claudia McCarthy, and the Imagine production team was Daniel Moore. This content is brought to you by the Australian Institute of Architects, Emerging Architects and Graduates Network, in collaboration with Open Creative Studio. This content does not take into account specific circumstances and should not be relied on in that way. This content does not constitute legal, financial, insurance, or other types of advice. You should seek independent verification or advice before relying on this content in circumstances where loss or damage may result. The Institute endeavours to publish content that is accurate at the time it is published, but does not accept responsibility for content that may or will become inaccurate over time.